listening to Yale Radio, WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.
Today on our show, we're talking with Spencer Tunick, the artist. Spencer, thanks for being with us today.
What's up? How you doing?
Good, good. So, to begin with, for listeners who know your work or don't, I want to talk a little bit about your upcoming show, which is in Munich. I couldn't help but smile when I saw you posted on Facebook, Tunick in Munich, coming up. I know in this show, the bodies will be painted. Maybe you can just tell us a little bit about that, or how this is being organized, or why this is a particularly exciting show for you.
The curators from the Bavarian State Opera in Munich, their arts curators, their visual arts curators, decided that they wanted to commission me to interpret Wagner's Ring, the four-part play. It's like 16 hours, and to come up with something visually that reflects either the feeling or the essence or some symbolism within the play. And I thought this was great. You know, as a kid, I'd listened to Wagner, and in military school, I played in first clarinet in a marching band and in an orchestra, and I was first solo on Lohengrin, which is one of his pieces. And so I thought it would be wonderful, and I'm pretty much aware of a lot of his controversial past and the duality of working with nudes in Germany, groups of naked people. So it's a great challenge to be invited to make a work there.
By the duality of working with naked people, do you mean kind of like Holocaust imagery sort of thing?
Yes, any imagery of nudes in Germany is going to raise eyebrows, and sort of to recontextualize the body, the meaning of the body in 2012 is a great challenge. To sort of turn it over into something else that you know touches upon the past, but also takes the body away from war, away from death, and so. So it's definitely a challenge, and I thought that when I watched The Ring, I thought that some of the imagery could be people with body paint on them, totally covered, not translucent, and do it in a way that is not hokey or gimmicky, and that's the challenge.
So tell me a little bit about that. I've seen your work for many years, which I know of as, and I will talk more about that in a minute, as large groups of people have taken their clothes off and have been photographed. How does everybody get painted? How does that get applied? That seems...
Well, when I did a colored work in 2010 in England, where I was commissioned by a concert called The Big Chill, who has a tradition of being a true arts and music festival where they really do engage top-notch contemporary artists to collaborate, such as Tracy Emin or the Tate Modern had works there. And they were researching, I wanted to paint people, and they were researching companies in France and in Belgium. And then...
companies that could supply paint for that kind of thing.
Right, right. And then...
Like a non-toxic...
Non-toxic body paint companies. And then someone, a friend of mine, said, you know, Spencer, the largest body paint company in the United States is 10 miles away from you. And my eyes lit up, and... It was, you know, it's called Merrin, and they have a factory, a huge factory. So they made, I worked with a chemist, and they made me a special body paint that had a little bit of water resistance to it, and was perfect for quickly applying a coat that was not translucent, covered the skin, that was safe, and so I was blown away. And the process of people putting it on is really crazy and insane, because everyone puts it on themselves, and obviously they can't get their back, so you have people that are touching each other that would not normally touch each other, because not everyone comes as a couple. So the interaction between strangers was pretty intense. And maybe that goes somewhat with your hugging project in your book, your new book.
Well, perhaps, yes. That's interactive in a sense. So let me understand. People gathering, the exact process is what? People gather at a certain time. They take their clothes off, and as they come in or are led into the area, they're given paint to apply to themselves?
Right, they're given paint and a canister that's 4 ounces big, and that will be applied to their bodies by themselves and by their friends and by their next-door naked neighbors. Hmm. And it takes, I would say, like 10 minutes to do it yourself. Hmm. And so we have...
With the exclusion of your back, of course. 10 minutes to cover all the parts that you can reach yourself.
Right. 10 minutes. No, maybe 10 minutes for everything to get done. Hmm. And
there's a little left over, or I guess it's gauged, so there's just enough for...
There's just enough. I think we have maybe... We order... We don't really know how many people are showing up for this one, because it's always hard to get... People think everyone is pretty free in Germany with their bodies, but it's different, you know, 200 people spread out in a park on a Sunday is probably the population of people in Germany that want to get naked on a Sunday in a park. To get over 1,000 people nude in Germany is very difficult, and so we're overestimating the amount of paint we need, and I would be happy with 1,400 red people, 700 gold people, 100 blue, 100 green. So that's what I would be happy with, you know.
And they would, so they all paint themselves. They're somewhat directed. You photograph them, and then that.
Right. We start out in one location, which is a huge, massive city street, where I'll fill up the area and sort of make the dragon's breath, the flame of the dragon's mouth. And then I'm hoping to turn those bodies around and sort of bombard a location where Hitler gave many speeches, and there were many rallies in Nazi Germany in the 40s and 30s. And then I will bring the bodies around to in front of the opera house, where I'll form...
So they're really all being directed and moved.
Yeah, it's sort of a waltz through the city. And so then 700 gold people will form a gold ring.
Wait, sorry to interrupt, but then how are they directed? Through megaphones or a series of...
Sometimes when the numbers get above 3,000 or 4,000, we need a sound system spread out throughout the city. But 2,000 people and under, you can communicate with a megaphone. Hmm. And so then we'll have a group of people that are while I'm working with the red people, the gold people will come into place and form a ring, and then I'll have the dragon's breath pierce the ring by moving the people through the city into the ring area, and then I'll work...
Creating that image, essentially.
Right.
Which you mean by piercing, you're creating that visual image with all the different
right.
colored people assembled in a particular order.
Right. So they'll enter the gold. I'll make some works with the gold ring, just the gold people, and then I'll bring the red people in. And I also make a video artwork as well. So the people sort of entering the ring will be more presented in video. And then I'll make works with red and gold people.
The video work is being shot by one person or a few people?
I have two cinematographers that shoot the video. I don't, at every exhibition, after I do an installation at a museum, such as at the Baltic or Lyon biennial or other exhibitions at museums, the museum usually commissions a short video artwork, and I create that as well with often two filmmakers, and I work with an editor who completed New York. I don't really push that as in the marketplace just because there's just so much time to do everything.
What do you mean not pushing it? I mean, as opposed to being the art as much as the images are?
Right. I don't really have a market, because what happens is that you get all these people to take a leap of faith and give you so much of themselves. In return, the museum gives everyone a print, an original print.
Everyone who participates.
Right, an original C print that's, you know, has no corporate logos on it or no museum logos, and it's just an artwork by me, and that's what they get as a gift. And but everyone wants the video, and so to put a price tag on it, you're really kind of like alienating your audience. You can do that with, I could make a shorter version or a longer version for different scenarios, but I haven't created sort of a system for that yet. But right now, so the video exists as an artwork, but it's sort of is more accessible.
It's like, well, it's a document of
right.
It's handled like a document of the artwork.
Exactly. But it's pseudo-documentary, pseudo-conceptual. It really could stand on itself as an artwork if I chose to bring it up to that sort of status or stage.
Well, I mean, it feels like the way you're working is a lot like Christo in a way, in some matters of it, and he had some of those issues too of what's in the market or not. Is this film being made by the Maisley brothers in artwork? Is it his artwork? Is it? And he handles it in a fairly strict way. He's Well, I mean, he doesn't let anybody commission anything or accept any grants from anyone on any terms, which is...
Yeah, he's like the one lucky person or unlucky person to have that ability.
Well, he said it's because he was born behind the Iron Curtain. He said if he was born here, he wouldn't be thinking that way. He doesn't think. He wouldn't be thinking,
right.
So I need total control. He said that's where I come from.
Right.
He said I may be into control, too, because I'm an artist, but I don't need that much control.
Right.
So let's talk a little bit about how something like this is funded, is created.
Well, it's very difficult for me to go into a country and hide 1,000 people around a corner and make my work. Maybe 50 people or 100 people before my work was more known. 50 to 100 people standing on a street corner could be a early morning bird watching tour,
right?
or historical architectural tour, but and for an American with no connections to politicians, to city council, to police, it's very difficult for me to even begin to apply for a permit and explain to people that they have to look beyond their laws and create this window of opportunity, even if there's a law against it, to sort of set precedent with my work. And so mostly my works in European countries and South American countries and U.S. countries, and the U.S., excuse me, are commissioned by contemporary art museums and contemporary art biennials. As of lately, I've done a lot of work with an environmental group called Greenpeace. But most of the time, the museums commission me and fund it and find sponsors that fund their projects.
Hmm. Sponsors that fund the museums, that fund
right.
You.
In the early days, when my wife Kristen was designing flyers, I would stand on a street corner in New York City on Ludlow and Houston, and from 10 o'clock at night to 4 in the morning, I would handpick people and hand out flyers.
Let's talk about that a little bit. Moving back to you're getting out of school and up to that point, how did that come about when you're standing on the corner handing out flyers? Because I want to talk about what happened in the ensuing years, but how did you get to that point where you're handing out flyers and this is part of your artwork?
Well, I, when I was at ICP, International Center of Photography, I spent a lot of time in the library. And my history of art teacher was Sam Samore. And I discovered artists like Yayoi Kusama, Carolee Schneeman, artists that work with groups of people. And I had this idea of working on the streets with individuals, and I was always had this picture in my mind of what happens if I had too many individual people to work with. Could I organize them all in one work? And I decided, as opposed to doing it on, you know, somewhere in Brooklyn, or I decided to do it in front of the United Nations, my first one, because I kept the same mentality of my individual nude portraits, which is if you have a location that you want to capture, to go for it. And so in a way, working with 20 people was the same as working with one person. So I made a work at the United Nations. To organize this work, I would stand out. I actually made flyers to strangers and called up everyone who wanted to pose for me in individual.
And this was one of the first works. This was before you were standing on a corner?
Yeah, thank you for clarifying that. Yeah, this was in 94. This is the first work. And then after making it and being successful at...
how many people? I'm sorry to
interrupt. That was 28 people.
28 people.
And then after that I met Kristen, who is in here with us. Hi, Chrissy.
Hi.
Chrissy
said, let's make your invitation a little bit, let's make it look good, and let's design it, and let's print it with offset printing some limited edition black and white flyers, or I would only print 1,000, or I'd only print 2,000, and then we would kind of sort of get an exact percentage of people showing up. And so I stood on the corner of Houston and Ludlow for a month handing out flyers for Arrow to Washington, where I wanted to make this.
And what year is this now?
This is in 95. And then I got around, I think it was 15% of the people that I handed flyers to came. And that was my first work over.
Which is how many? How many people is there?
Around 150 people.
150
came.
People.
And so that's...
Which means they all took the train.
They took a train, they came by cabs, they walked, bicycle. Some people jumped in that just saw it on the street and just...
And essentially this was an independent project. So they paid to come down there, or their travel expenses.
Right. Everyone, this is before I kind of knew what was happening. You know, it was very organic. I didn't apply for a permit because it's...
You were experimenting still with,
right,
with the process.
Exactly. And
so the people paid their way down there, and then you organized them when they were down there.
Right. I worked quickly with a ladder to get above the people so I could see more of the plane of bodies. And I had people lying down, because if they were standing up, you would just see a bunch of, you know, just for me visually, you would just see black hair. But if you spread the bodies out, you would see flesh. And if you lied them down, you would see more flesh. And so the idea was to sort of create these sort of Jackson Pollock-esque living explosions on the street. And at the time, I was going through a lot of, issues with death and mass murder and terrorism. And so I would create these sort of living explosions.
That was before 9/11, though.
Right. Right. And... But I was very, very attuned to, like, bus explosions and terrorist activity and mass murder and issues of Rwanda and genocide. And so I had this, like, idea to say, if this is what death looks like, you know, more of a tame version of death. This is the vulnerability. This is the body. Here it is spread out. So, but at other times it became very, you know, other works were a little bit more abstract that really didn't touch upon death, which was me sort of doing these sort of black and white Ellsworth Kelly-esque shapes on the city. And I was having this duality between making these explosions of life and touching upon, you know,
One's political and one's very formal.
Right.
Right. I mean, the politics, there's really interesting content there, you know, with death. I think of, you know, the images of My Lai and all these kind of associations, and then yeah, very formal.
So it was more of, I called that series my reaction zone, because I was more of reacting to, visually, to things happening around me. And so I felt like I was in this zone, in this invisible zone at the time, because I hadn't been arrested. And so, and soon my ideas became a little bit more lofty. I wanted to work in Times Square.
But that work, that was successful in D.C., that one that you were talking about.
Which, the one, Hour to Washington,
yeah,
was successful, yes. Mm-hmm. The first image, I was, visually it's not as successful as it could have been if I had, again, a permit and time. But the second setup where I brought people around the corner on Crosby Street, that's a beautiful work on the cobblestone piece, on the cobblestone street. And so that was visually very successful and satisfying. So I was like, I have something here. I want to do a few more. I never thought I would continue doing that. But
and did you start getting shows? When was your first show of work?
I had an exhibition at Alleged Gallery.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
On Ludlow Street.
That was a pretty hip place.
Yes, and then...
was that one of the first shows?
I think Aaron was thinking about closing down the gallery, or he put it on hold for a while, and then I approached him, and he said yes, and we decided to do a show, and it was very successful.
And was that one of the first times you were selling a lot of work? I mean, how did that trajectory go? Were you...
I sold some work, you know. It was like when the Legend was first kind of... before Mike Mills and Thomas Campbell and Barry McGee, a little bit at the beginning of the Legend, so I don't know how the clientele wasn't quite there. Mm. But then Kelly Lamb had this artist space gallery called Thicket on below Canal Street, off of Broadway on Lisbonard, and I had another show there, and I think Tom Sachs showed there, but I can't confirm that. So I had a show there, and then I just continued making work. And then,
And were you teaching during this time? I mean, part of what's interesting to, I think, a lot of people that are listening to the show, so what we talked about is how artists are balancing their careers.
I was teaching people how to take their clothes off in under 15 seconds.
So no other, but you didn't have another income other than...
I was photographing for my dad, who had a keychain viewer business in upstate New York in the Catskills.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. And so I really wouldn't... what I would do is I would go upstate, take pictures of the guests in the hotel.
Well, what year was that?
This was... I would say 94,
95. Really? Doing it. That up
and then I would drive the film like in the middle of the night, 45 minutes to Kerhonks in New York from some faraway place to a lab in a friend's house, and I would do an E6 process in a little tank myself. Which is insane, because an E6...
Well, and all the images are this big.
Right, and they're slides, and they're vision. It's insanity. There's 9 chemicals that you have to be accurate with, because it's a slide film. It's not C-print.
Right.
There's no longitude. You know, it's difficult.
Yeah, no, I understand.
And so, then I would come, I would have to dry the film, and then I would have to come back home around 1 in the morning, and then I would... work till 2, punching these out into little viewers, and then I'd wake up at 7 in the morning and then sell them to the guests the next day as they went in for breakfast.
Right.
But I was making a lot of money.
Really? It's hard to imagine there's a lot of money in that.
So, yeah, it is. You know, a little keychain, you sell it for $5, and, you know, it's like candy. People just want more and more of them.
Wow.
It's still like candy, but they don't...
Yeah, I would want one of those.
Yeah. So I would I did that job to fund my my artwork in the city. And I, you know, whenever I would do my individual portraits of nudes, I would take people out for breakfast afterwards. So I would be taking out 8 to 9 people for breakfast. And see, my money ran out when I decided not to do that. Mm. And my wad of cash that I had in my overcoat hidden in my closet. Mm. Chrissy is still finding money in my in my coat.
Some crumpled up pieces.
Crumpled up $100 bills. So don't go through my pockets.
So between the different projects, you're also doing individual portraits, you're saying?
Right, I was doing my individual series as well. So I have the group series and then the individual series. And then...
And then at what point did something seem to really shift for you? When did, you know, I was in New York at that same time. I remember seeing your flyers and things happening and was growing. When do you feel like a decisive shift came where...
Well, visually, the shift came when I made a work in Central Park where half the bodies, where all the bodies took up half the frame of the photograph. So it was really a color field. You know, it was really sort of this separating the earth from the bodies in a very pure way. And I said, this is something that I've hit something and I want to sort of continue trying.
And what year was it?
This was in 96. Mm-hmm. And then in 97, I decided to do a personal project called Naked States, where I wanted to photograph a nude in every state, an individual nude in every state. And if I could find a group, I would do a group too, you know, so hoping that I could get maybe 5 big group works in. And then Kristen and I, who's in the studio, hey, Chrissy. We bought a van for $3,000 in Woodstock, New York, from an ex-cop.
And this was when, what year?
It was in 97, a camper van. And
a Volkswagen camper van?
It was a GMC camper van, like with a toilet, but it could park in a parking space, you know, so it wasn't long. It had a bed, and it was Chrissy decked it out with incense and beautiful pillows and tapestries. So, and this was a self-funded project. I asked all my friends and family and first-time collectors to buy a 20 by 24 or 16 by 20 or 20 by 24 inch black and white photograph, sight unseen. And then when I came back, I would let them choose one image from the 50 states.
Say that again. So that's a great idea. I love that. That's the way you were raising money for the project.
Right.
You offered your collectors a print.
And family. Dad bought one.
And family. Sight unseen. And they could pick from whatever you brought back.
Yeah, they could pick from whatever I brought back. And then I rented...
And that was enough to help fund the trip.
Yes.
Gas was cheap.
It was like 97 cents a gallon in the Midwest. But still we ran out of money for gas. So I think it was like Barry from Baobab Frames in the East Village gave us a really good price on frames because he believed in the project. And I think the frames were like $250 or something like that, $250 for 20 by 24 at the time. And so we sold like 15 prints, so we had like well over $15,000 to do this trip. And we were sleeping in front of coffee shops, on sidewalks, behind churches. On a rare occasion, we would sleep...
In the van.
In the van. Yeah. And then when the coffee shop would open up, then we would go in there and take sort of a traveling shower in the coffee shop bathroom and use the facility.
And this year was... This was
97. So then there was this independent film director who wanted to follow us around and make an independent film on it. And we said, sure. And so they met up with us on...
And who was that?
Arlene Donnelly. And so she met up with us on different stops. And the film started to get a lot of attention, and it turned out to be a really good film. And HBO wanted to acquire it. So it won a lot of film festival awards. It won best film at
So yeah. that was very helpful in just all the work being more visible to everyone.
Right.
All over
so
the world.
It's people think it's an HBO film, but it was an independent film that won awards, including the best documentary at AFI, which was a few years ago. It was filmed. The award ceremony was filmed on CBS. So it was like AFI is a big film festival. So it won many awards, and then when it came back from winning the awards and it showed on HBO, so people think it's like, some people think it's like my film. Mm. Some people think it's like an HBO film, but in actuality, it was an independent documentary that was then acquired after it was made by HBO. And it did really well. It showed after The Sopranos, and it was I think 13 million people saw it, and it was the highest rated documentary ever on HBO.
Amazing. I mean, there's nothing like that in the art world at all, with that kind of reach or that kind of power, you know? I mean, biennial doesn't touch that. I don't think 13 million people see the
value. The reason why I said yes to this film is because what I do is part of my artwork is gathering people, and you just can't do that by placing, you know, a quarter page ad in an art forum or in Time, you know, Trans or flash art. You know, you have to sort of get out there and work from the masses. If you hand out flyers in front of SCA or Columbia Art Department, you're not gonna get a high percentage of people. You have to really, you know, your palette is the city, and so your art store is really the city. And so I felt that not only would this be a great thing to document, but I felt that it would help me with my work with gathering people, because I really wanted to work on this series of group works. I wanted to see if they could get larger, and so it did work. Now it's, you know, besides from Germany, where it's really difficult to get people to pose, we really have to work hard at doing it. In other places, it's not as difficult for me in the U.S. because of that film, such as when I was commissioned by MoCA Cleveland, Museum of Contemporary Art Cleveland. I had almost 3,000 people pose for me in Cleveland, and who thought Cleveland would come out in that high number?
Right.
No, well, at least I didn't think so. And then in Buffalo, we had over 2,000 when I worked with the Albright-Knox Art Gallery.
Well, then wasn't Brazil a turning point, too? Wasn't there an enormous amount of people?
I think in Brazil, when I was in the biennial in Sao Paulo, what happened was I think there was a lot of constraint as far as the men holding back the women from actually being naked. A lot of, in a way, men not allowing their women to be naked and women being afraid of the men. And I think
that's interesting.
Yeah. You know, you think it's the opposite, that everyone's out because everybody...
Right, so you would
say free there, as opposed to...
I think people are free to wear that bikini that is almost invisible, but once, you know, your breasts or your genitals are fully exposed, that's really not done in Brazil. Your vision of Brazil is naked, but the actuality is actually just very, very tiny bikini and bathing suits, you know.
Hmm.
So, but really the watershed moment for me was in Chile, where I had protesters outside of my hotel room, approximately 400 conservative protesters, and we thought that maybe, you know, less than 400 people would actually show up the next, on Sunday, and...
You mean 400 people show up for the shoot?
Yeah, we thought maybe 400 people would show up. If we had 400 protesters, maybe we'll have 400 people. But what happened is everyone got so riveted by the protesters that all these open-minded people decided to use it as a catalyst for free expression in Chile, and over almost 5,000 people came.
Incredible.
And I was named Man of the Year of Chile, and now there's a saying in Chile, before and after tunic. And that's, you know, I had like this Michael Jackson moment down there as far as like attention. I could go and retire there, and it's pretty cool. So to this day, I'm like, it could have happened to a rock band going down there or something where the youth would have,
it was the right time,
and people embraced it and just exploded.
And what year was that?
That was 2002. And then I realized, you know, sure, these people are running through the streets crazy, you know, chanting and holding up Chilean flags. But if there's a way to communicate with them better, with a better sound system, if I can get this many people again, I could really orchestrate something wonderful.
Mm.
And so I was given that opportunity by the Institut de Cultura in Barcelona, where I actually worked with over 7,000 people, so in a controlled situation. So it's sort of like you're making work. It's not like I can make work in a studio and then come out boom and show it. You're sort of showing your mistakes as well. Not so much, you know, you're making works in public, and you're not only going to succeed. So a lot of people see your failures, but they're not. They're just maybe visual failures, but they're not experiential failures. And most of the time, I think I succeed visually.
Well, and there's also something happening, you know, in the initial dichotomy you talked about between the content and the form. Now using color, that's even more formal in a way. But there remains issues of content, like with the ring happening now, and it seems that those have come together.
Right. I think that, you know, I would need a very big budget. I'd have to be working with budgets that, you know, that artists that are well beyond me would have to be able to get people to come the day before and practice. It's, you know, to get 2,000 people, you can't get 2,000. This is not North Korea. You can't get 2,000 people showing up the day before and then practicing. Or maybe you can, but I think you'd have to start paying people for more of their time, because getting naked is such a there's a amount of trust, but it's often not every, you know, you would have maybe 80% of the people there for, you know, to make art. 20% thinking it's going to be something else, you know, but then they realize they're making art, you know. It's like, I'm not sure I could practice with people. So what I'm trying to say is that even though I've been doing this for so long, it still remains a mystery, you know, often.
Oh, what do you mean? There's a whole mix of people are coming there for art, but then other people think it's also just this kind of singles event or something?
Not so much a singles event, but so, you know, not everyone.
But something
everyone
social that it's not.
Something like, they know they're making art, but they don't know to the extent of how, like, I'm going to put them through this waltz through the city, and that you have to stick with it, and that we're doing setup after setup after setup, and I'm not making only work for myself, I'm making work for them and with them, and so it's sort of this big collaboration, and, you know, sometimes, you know, I don't know, there are not many artists doing that with non-paid participants, so even though there is a barter of a print, but Santiago Serra is working with groups, and obviously Vanessa Beecroft, and
Gregory Crutzen a little bit.
Right, definitely, and it's very interesting. It never gets old for me, and that's why, you know, and I'm able to work with the bodies in different pockets, working indoors, working with 100 people with adornment or props, working with 5,000 people. So I have these different pockets, these different series going on at once. And I'm designing a new website now that hopefully will be up in a month that sort of separates these pockets into areas.
And to begin to wrap this up, the future of funding this kind of thing. You mentioned a whole bunch of artists there who all, I think, fund their work through different means, these kind of experiences. Christo is another one who funds it his own way through the sale of his sculptures. What's the future of how you're funding this? How would it grow or not?
Well, I still need the museum commission for the large-scale work. Unless 10 years go by and my works are selling for, you know, half of what Cindy Sherman's selling for, you know, be modest, right? It'll be impossible for me to raise the money to do works myself. But in this new age, I think there's the ability for artists to fund their works through the internet, through crowdfunding, such as Kickstarter. The unfortunate thing about Kickstarter is that you can fail in public, that they leave up your project. And no artist wants to be known as not being able to sell their work or raise the money to do their work, because then the collectors or your collectors or don't believe in you, you know? Because you, it's not like you're asking for $5 million. You're asking for an amount that could be attainable. And if you don't reach that point, then it's sort of embarrassing. And that I did a Kickstarter campaign, and I raised $116,000.
It was successful.
It was successful. Yeah, it was the most, the highest project, the highest amount of money ever raised for an art project on Kickstarter.
What was the goal?
To make a work at the Dead Sea.
I mean, the amount.
The goal was 60.
Okay, so way overfunded.
Much of that work went back to the organization. A lot of it went to producing the work and mailing out 700 rewards. Mm. It's a lot of work afterwards, and the more you make, the more you have to work in a way to get all to FedEx a roll of print back to Europe is like $200 and. It was
so what are you saying about that model? I mean, on one hand, you're saying there are these new models like Kickstarter, but they're problematic in other ways.
Yeah, they're problematic in other ways because, you know, plus if you raise the money for a project and you get the money from the Amazon account, let's say I didn't get permission to do the work, then I have, there's no way to give the money back without doing it individually, 700 individual returns. So I was like, if I don't get down to the Dead Sea with 1,000 people, I have to get down there somewhere, risk arrest, get down there with 1,000 people, or get down there with 100 people.
I mean, right now there's no choice. Once you get funded, you're also stuck. You're
exactly.
Out of the Dead Sea.
If you're stuck and you take that money, and then they said, well, you have a year to use the money.
So that's very interesting. I mean,
it gets more complicated than you think. And
absolutely.
Just a flat-out commission of
I can tell
money.
You a big story about the Kickstarter project I did last summer with my wife. It was successful, but it became very complicated.
Yeah, things beyond your control
right.
just become involved in.
Right.
And then people don't get the rewards because they forget to fill out the survey, and then you have people for years contacting you that you didn't get, and then you don't know if they got their reward because... You know, what happens if they bought a $750 reward in France and you mail it and you don't know if they got it and then they say they don't get it and how can you prove it? You know, it's like nothing.
Right.
It's insane.
So what do you think about that? I mean, you mentioned that as I was saying, what is the kind of future of funding? And you said there's these things, but now artists can do a lot online.
I think
Kickstarter is good or no?
I think it's good if you have a team of friends helping you, you know, if you really have people devoted to this project as volunteers that are going to help you do the mailing, run it. My project when I did it had, you know, 50 volunteers and 8 crew members. But when I got back to the office,
and that was initiated by you or
I was commissioned by various people in Israel to do it. It was very difficult to get a museum involved.
Because of that, you decided to use Kickstarter for the first time, or who?
As a last resort, it was Kickstarter or to
help raise money that the museum and the people who are commissioning.
The museums didn't want to touch it because it was too controversial. They had never worked outside, you know, the confines of their museum.
So the money had to be raised for them to notice.
No, the museums were even frightened because of the religious parties. You know, I was threatened by the religious parties, and I was called beastly, and they have to stop me by any means possible. And I was brought up by the religious parties in Knesset and the government. And then we ended up even doing the work on a Saturday so no one could protest, you know.
Brilliant.
But even though there were 5 planes buzzing in trying to destroy the installation, that was at close range, almost exploding on top of the models. But that's another story.
Oh my God.
That's part two. No, but I think just the traditional way of making an artist, I think the traditional way of making an artwork, getting someone to believe in your artwork, such as a curator or a gallery and selling it the traditional way, sort of the calm way to do it. Kickstarter is a little bit more hectic, although it's fun the first time, but I'm not sure if I could do it again. So that's why you don't see many, you know, too many artists working in the gallery world heading towards Kickstarter, because it's, you know, it's a lot of concentration on other things when you should be really working on the work and getting other people to believe in it on a different level. I hope I'm making sense.
You are. Let's just end it with that, though. You know, there are artists, there are students, there's all kinds of people listening to it to speak to just what you said, that the main thing is not so much to spend time on things like Kickstarter, although obviously they're helpful to some people, but to spend time on getting people you know to get engaged in the work, right?
Right.
Maybe just speak to that or say, if you want to say anything.
I think people can do it without Kickstarter, because I think, you know, to raise, you could, if you believe in your work, just to get people on the phone and to write them a handwritten letter or a typed letter to get them to buy a work up front before it's made, if you want to make something that doesn't exist, and then give them some sort of result afterwards. I think that's, you don't need the internet to do that. You just need a friend and a phone. Hmm.
Spencer, thanks so much for doing this interviewing and being with us today. I really appreciate it.
That's great. Let's go eat.
You're listening to Yale Radio, WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.